Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, March 27th, 2020. There may be a check in the mail or an electronic deposit to your bank account being posted soon. They're printing that money, some of it digitally, in Washington, D.C. right now. We'll update the passage of the bailout bill coming up shortly here on the podcast. But I'm leading today with a very serious set of allegations that have been made against Joe Biden, the leading candidate of the Democratic Party for president, facing Donald Trump in November. And earlier this week, I reported on Tara Reid and how the Time's Up nonprofit, which raised some $24 million to support individuals who wanted to come forward with serious allegations of sexual harassment and or sexual assault. And I reported to you that Tara Reid was turned down by that organization after one of the top officials had given her encouraging indications that they would be supporting her. And I want to compliment and commend the website, news site called The Hill, and its TV offshoot, Hill TV. Many of my listeners are aware of the daily program called Rising with Crystal and Cigar. The co-hosts are Crystal Ball and Cigar and Jetty. They've been doing some really excellent work, but this tops almost anything I have seen them do. Because acknowledging that they cannot yet independently confirm the allegations of Tara Reid against Joe Biden, they nevertheless featured her in a powerful interview, and I'm going to play a clip for you in a moment. Now, what's important about this is that this could derail the campaign of Joe Biden and the Democratic establishment since Bernie Sanders won the Nevada caucuses, has tilted the playing field, and it led to the incredible resurrection of the political life of Joe Biden. And what we're hearing is a stronger allegation than the one that came from Christine Blasey Ford, because she admitted she'd had a few beers when she alleged Brett Kavanaugh assaulted her way back in high school. And we've seen the vilification of the accusers of Harvey Weinstein and many other powerful men. And I want to concede that many of the accusations that are made are incomplete, and they are prone to attack because, geez, Blasey Ford had been drinking, and she couldn't remember the location of the party. But I believe Christine Blasey Ford and the other allegations that came forward from separate accusers against Brett Kavanaugh, which were ignored in that fake FBI investigation when they stalled the confirmation hearings for a week. Well, Tara Reid didn't tell her whole story previously, because when she simply alleged sexual harassment by her boss, Joe Biden, she worked on his Senate staff, she was smeared because at one point she wrote a letter or a post to a friend that included praise for Russia. And I don't know much about her views on Russia and why that is significant. But the smears against her came at the same time that Russia has been demonized for rigging the 2016 election. Putin has become Dr. Evil to the fans of the Rachel Maddow telenovela, the mainstream media, which fueled that whole narrative about Russia meddling in the 2016 election. And so it became just this easy go-to. Anybody who had a ruble in their desk drawer or a friend in Russia or any contact, you know, Bernie Sanders, he went there on his honeymoon. That shows you what a commie fellow traveler he is. And so Tara Reid did not want to relive this whole ugly episode that she says she endured. And so I'm going to play for you a clip. This is from her interview with Crystal and Cigar on Hill TV on Thursday. And I have linked to the detailed story, which has a lot of verbatim quotes from the comments of Tara Reid. And this was published at the website called Law and Crime, which is run by Dan Abrams. You may know him. He's a legal beagle. He was an early host on MSNBC. I think he ran the network there for a while. And so between the publication of the video by The Hill and what I consider to be a corroborating piece of coverage from this Law and Crime website, I think you deserve to hear this. And I know that I'm going to be attacked by Biden partisans because I've been so openly critical of Biden and his other weaknesses, his political baggage, his possibly, being a victim of early onset or some other form of dementia. But partisans who support Biden ignore this at their own peril. And we have seen precious little mainstream media coverage of this. It's mostly being covered, if you do a Google search, by websites and media outlets like Newsmax that are unabashed promoters of Donald Trump, the sexual predator whose violations of women are numerous and well-documented. So here in her own voice is Tara Reid explaining what happened on that warm summer day in 1993 when she was dispatched to deliver to Senator Biden his gym bag.
I remember the assault itself and then the aftermath and the reverberating effect of that. And I was walking to the Capitol, through the Russell Building, you go down the stairs, you go down, and then it was somewhere in either the Russell or Capitol, I'm not sure, in an alcove. But we were in a semi-private place, it wasn't completely private. He was at first talking to someone, they went away, and then he said, come here. And then when I gave him the gym bag, it happened all in one motion, almost, and he had me against the wall, and then his hands were down my skirt and up my skirt, and I was wearing, I wasn't wearing tights or anything, and he then, with his hand, went from there and entered me with his hand and as he was trying to kiss me and saying things to me. So when I tell you what happened, it's hard because everything kind of happened at once, but there were incremental parts to it. Mm-hmm. And meaning he was trying to kiss me and I was pulling away. And what I remember of that time is feeling really shocked, a surprise, because there was no real conversation right beforehand. There was no precursor. It just happened. And then when he did that, I was obviously pulling away, and he pulled back and said, come on, man, I heard you liked me, something to that effect. And that's what kind of jolted me. Like, I was trying to think what I did wrong to bring that on me. And then he looked angry and irritated with me, and that's when I knew it was really, I was in a very difficult position because he was my boss and he was like my dad's age at the time. And I trusted him and looked up to him. And it was not like I disliked him. I liked him, but I just didn't like him in that way. And it was just shocking. It was shattering, actually. And he said to me when he pulled back, he pointed his finger at me and he said, you're nothing to me. You're nothing. Mm. And straighten his clothes, and he went away. And I don't remember. I know I went to the restroom to clean up, but I don't remember exactly. I remember the next memory I have is of the Russell Building. There's these long windows that are very tall, and this empty kind of like, there's back stairs. And I was sitting on the back stairs, and I just remember the coldness and my whole body shaking and feeling alone and feeling scared and not knowing what to do.
So this is very powerful testimony. I acknowledge that she is an accuser, and there's likely no direct evidence to corroborate this. Tara Reid has said that she told just a handful of people about it at the time, and that she had declined to reveal this, as I mentioned, because of the way she and Lucy Flores, a former state legislator from Nevada, who had serious allegations against Biden, how those were treated. Now, I want to be clear, clear about this, that this is not a case of sniffing her hair from behind or rubbing her shoulders or making remarks that might be misinterpreted that were intended as complimentary. This was a case of digital penetration. Not to be too crude, but what that means is he stuck his finger or fingers inside her sexual cavity. And let me remind you of the sensationalized case from Stanford University, where a swimming star named Brock Turner got drunk at a frat party, took the woman outside, a young woman, and he was interrupted from what was described as a sexual assault on her because she was drunk and did not have the capacity to consent. But he was convicted of rape, and the testimony showed that the farthest he got, he may have been planning to rape her. But it was digital penetration. Brock Turner got 6 months in county jail. The judge was removed by a vote of the community. And so this is serious. This is not simply a political takedown or a smear. And what's going to happen next? Will major media outlets allow Tara Reid's voice to be heard? Will the Democratic National Committee take notice of this? Because the right-wing media and the Trump campaign will have no shame. Obviously, the hypocrisy of an attack against Biden by Donald Trump would be seen by many people as just, you know, unbelievable. But this will fuel the whole right-wing echo chamber, and Trump won't have to say anything. If there is a debate in the fall between Trump and Biden, the subject might be brought up. But as we've seen, the complicity of major corporate media outlets in the resuscitation of Joe Biden's political life. Once again, like 2016, the Democrats are running a candidate who is fatally flawed. And they know it. And the flaws are self-inflicted wounds. Just like I argue Hillary Clinton had in 2016. Now, hers were not sexual in nature. She intentionally put her emails on a private server because she didn't want the Freedom of Information Act and Jason Leopold to get a hold of them. And the cover-up of that, the whitewashing by James Comey in his first exoneration of Clinton, it sealed the deal. And at great expense to the nation and to the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton went down in flames. Now, I didn't know about this before then, and I've argued about the weaknesses of Biden as a candidate. But to me, this is a clincher. And we will see how it is handled as we move forward. There's the whole fog of the coronavirus pandemic that the media is using to exclude coverage of a lot of important stories. And ultimately, I do see this as an important role for the media in this country to share these allegations with the public. Meanwhile, the dismissive approach to the coverage of Bernie Sanders continues in the New York Times, and they continue to assign Sidney Ember, whose bias against Sanders has been obvious in the article she wrote from the campaign trail over the last year or so. And the headline reads, Sanders sees crisis as a match for his ideas. And even as she explains how Bernie Sanders is continuing his campaign of ideas, and he has refused to get out of the race, they weave that in with a lot of smears. So Sanders was on the floor. In fact, I shared a video last night on Facebook of Bernie Sanders' debate performance in the Senate on Thursday when he excoriated Republicans for trying to roll back the proposed $600 federal add-on to unemployment benefits for the duration. And as we've reported, it was Lindsey Graham and some colleagues, Tim Scott, Rick Scott, Ben Sasse. They were ready to hold up this package to try to reduce benefits because they were concerned that some people, as Bernie points out, who make $12, $14 an hour, might actually end up getting a bigger paycheck from unemployment than they were getting from their employer. And that this is somehow criminal, as seen by the people who've just shoveled trillions of dollars into the coffers of corporate America. And while this Sidney Ember article quotes him, listen to the way she does it. This is in her voice. Excuse him, forgive him for wanting working people to get a few more bucks for a few more months as part of the sweeping stimulus bill that was being debated on the Senate floor. Excuse him, forgive him for not wanting to punish the poor and working people, those are quotes, struggling to weather the economic meltdown caused by the pandemic. Direct quote from Sanders. My Republican colleagues are very distressed. Oh my God, the universe is collapsing, he said. Oh my word, will the universe survive? And then she reverts to her snark voice. With the virus bringing the nation to a virtual stop, there is no presidential campaign for Sanders to engage in. And if there were, he is almost hopelessly behind Joseph R. Biden Jr. in the delegate count. But Sanders is still running, and in large part, allies and aides say, because he believes he can meld this moment of national crisis with the progressive policy work, policy agenda that has been his life's work. Then they go to a former Sanders staffer, Nick Carter. For someone who has built a career out of campaigning against the inequality of our health care system, this is prime time. A little bit later, she writes, his campaign says he's still actively running for president. There is other concrete evidence that he is. On Tuesday, his team confirmed that he planned to participate in an April debate with Biden if there is one. She fails to mention that Biden is refusing to engage in further debate with Sanders. And later in this article, many of his supporters are still holding out faint hope that he can win the nomination, arguing that the coronavirus outbreak has made even unlikely scenarios possible. Now get this. We saw this remarkable and unexplained rejuvenation of Biden's campaign when he was dead in the water. It can happen to him, but it can't possibly happen to Sanders. Roughly 50% of the delegates have been allocated, and it is an uphill climb for Sanders. But if the media were to expose this sexual assault allegation against Joe Biden, wouldn't the fortunes shift again? And wouldn't Democrats, because there are only two people left in the race, unless there's a backroom deal at a convention that may or may not happen in Milwaukee, Sanders would become the nominee. So I feel that this is a very significant indication of the perversion in the media political alliance between the Democratic Party and major media outlets. It really stuns me. All right, now to the passage of the bailout stimulus corporate giveaway package on Capitol Hill today. Nancy Pelosi, who is not invited to the signing ceremony, skillfully maneuvered around the lone voice of Republican Congressman Tom Massie of Kentucky. Now, in the past, I have offered praise to Tom Massie and to his former Republican, now independent, ally, Justin Amash of Michigan. Because while they are hardline conservatives, they stand up for the Fourth Amendment and our right to be free of unlawful surveillance. So I have some respect for Tom Massie. And what he did today took a lot of courage. Everybody else in the House hates him because, expecting that he would rise to demand a quorum count, which would be a step toward a recorded vote of yeas and nays, we heard bitching and moaning from members of both sides of the aisle. I got to go back to Washington. I might get coronavirus. Because Tom Massie is the only one demanding accountability for the passage of this huge package. Now, it zipped through the Senate 96-0 yesterday, and there was no doubt that it was going to pass. But both parties have ginned up this whole crisis mentality that we must act now, we must act big. And here are a couple of tweets from Massie. I swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. I take it seriously. In a few moments, I will request a vote on the package, which means members of Congress will vote on it by pushing yes, no, or present. It's pretty clear now, with enough members here to pass the bill, that Pelosi and the Republican boss, McCarthy, are still working together to block a recorded vote just to insulate members of Congress from accountability. Biggest spending hill in the history of mankind and no recorded vote? Question mark. And even Trump dumped on Massie, calling him a disaster for America. Quote, looks like a third-rate grandstander named Tom Massie, a congressman from, unfortunately, a truly great state, Kentucky, wants to vote against the new Save Our Workers bill in Congress. Oh, man. That's not the name of it. He made that up. It's a corporate bailout with crumbs for average Americans, and he calls it the Save Our Workers bill. Man, that's rich. And I'm not as rich as I used to be after what Trump has done to the stock market. Continuing to quote this tweet, he just wants the publicity. He can't stop it, only delay, which is both dangerous and costly. Workers and small businesses need money now in order to survive. And as I pointed out yesterday, a generous ballpark figure is that about 1/6 of the money would go to people and small business. And then he closes by saying, win back House, but throw Massie out of Republican Party. So I'm not going to recap the major elements of the bill. I've done that over the past few days. But on Facebook last night, a guy I know who he's a roadie and a guitar tech for traveling major rock and roll musical acts. And I've known him since Metallica took over the building where the secret studio used to be. And he was working for Metallica at the time. And we'll call him Aiden because that's his name. And he's a nice guy, but his politics are far right and he is a blind supporter of Trump. And so he posted an analysis of the pork, and there's plenty of pork and pork fat in this 880-page bill. And Aiden cited a very biased analysis from Forbes magazine, and I've put a link to it in the show file for you so you can look at it for yourselves. And it identifies mostly the pork that was inserted in Pelosi's House bill. Now, why did Pelosi write a bill? It's because the Senate bill was so lopsided in favor of corporate interests and unchecked bailouts. And while the items I'm going to list for you don't have much relation to the pandemic and the response to it, or even the general economy and what I think are potentially failed efforts to prop up the economy before we have weathered the crisis. But my generous interpretation of this is that Pelosi put these in the bill so that she could give them up in exchange for other improvements like that $600 in federal unemployment additions and some of the other things that they fixed requiring oversight of the money that's going to be shoveled out of the Treasury. So, the article cites that Pelosi asked for $35 million for the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., and got $25 million. She asked for $300 million for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and got $75 million. She asked for $1.2 billion, and this is kind of a green piece of legislation, to require airlines who get bailouts to purchase renewable jet fuel. And Forbes calls it expensive, quote, renewable jet fuel. That was $1.2 billion, and the Senate completely eliminated that clause. Now, this is how things work in Washington. And it's stinky. I don't dismiss that. But now let's take a look at a more balanced report from Politico. I've also linked to it in your show file. And for example, they lead with the gift that Mitch McConnell gave to the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And it supports, it provides funding and causes the FDA to approve innovative sunscreen products, which are being made by the conglomerate L'Oreal at a plant in Kentucky. They also made sure to bail out the casinos. These are the ones in Las Vegas, not the ones on Indian properties or in Indian, what do we call it, territories or reservations. Also, tucked into the bailout for airlines, the $25 billion, well, they inserted language to cover ticket agents. That means travel agents. Now, the airlines screwed the travel agents a long time ago by cutting and then eliminating their commissions. And in some ways, I don't particularly object to that, and I don't know who's responsible for inserting that. Also, there is a student loan tax benefit. The final package creates a new tax benefit for student loan borrowers whose employers help them pay off their debt. Under the bill, a company could pay up to $5,250 of an employee's student loan payments each year on a tax-free basis. So this originated with Senator Thune of South Dakota, Republican, Senator Warner of Virginia, Democrat, and it advances the agenda of Bernie Sanders. Now, I happen to think that that is a good benefit because at a time when young people who have burdensome student loans but don't have a big income that's now been cut off, I think that's important relief. And let's commend Cory Booker. He inserted language that doesn't cost the government anything, or at least not really, because he has inserted a clause that will provide free video conference and phone calls for inmates in federal prisons. Now, they have reduced the onerous collect call charges that benefit private phone companies, and it usually produces kickbacks to the prison systems. But I think that this is an important move at a time when all prison visiting has been cut off. And let's go for one more here. Relief for farmers. The stimulus provides $9.5 billion in emergency aid for the ag industry and replenishes $14 billion in spending authority to the Department of Agriculture's Commodity Credit Corporation. Now, I don't have the number in front of me, but the last time I saw it was like $29 billion that Trump has pushed out to major farming operations, agribusiness. Of course, they pretend it's family farmers who get the money because of his misguided trade war with China. And they have suffered real damage, but he's papered it over and tried to preserve the political support from farm states, which are mostly red, just by socializing it, giving them free money. And so when people like Aiden, oh, and there's another guy, my old general manager at a radio station, a guy who fired me one time, he posted with the cluck clucks over the Forbes items of the Kennedy Center and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Nothing about the nature of this massive government expenditure, which, as I say, mostly goes to bailout corporations. And here's a piece of interesting spin from an analyst at the New York Times, Neil Irwin. Headline: the U.S. is about to vastly increase its debt, period. That's a good thing, period. Now, remember that when Obama put together a very weak package of $800 billion to stimulate the economy in early 2009, the Republicans howled about this massive increase in the federal debt, the burden on our children, this deficit is going to kill us. Not anymore, because there is a Republican in the White House and they control the Senate. A couple of quick quotes here. The very large deficits on the way in 2020 are more likely to leave the U.S. in a better fiscal situation for the years ahead than an alternative in which the government is more tight-fisted but fails to prevent the widespread collapse of American businesses or help workers in desperate financial straits. Well, wait a minute. This is a really risky bet. Today, the stock market dropped again after 3 days of posting some recovery. That's on the day when this big bailout for corporate America, you know, finally got passed. And we always can speculate about what moves the market. But one speculation I would make is that people don't have confidence in Trump. He's calling to end this on Easter Sunday, and they know stock traders aren't stupid, that we have not even hit the apex, the peak of infections. And they argue that because the Fed has essentially reduced interest rates to zero, that this is like free money. But if inflation kicks up, the Fed will have to raise interest rates, and these bonds will, you know, I'm not an expert on bonds, but my perception, my guess, is that when interest rates rise, these bonds will either be worthless or they will have to be propped up through other forms of creative intervention. They're going to produce low yields and reduce the incentive for average Americans to save money to almost zero. And we know that 38% of Americans don't have $400 in savings. And here is a real lesson for our times as the rich get richer. The Federal Reserve has turned again to BlackRock. The nation's central bank has tapped the world's largest asset manager to help oversee the Fed's effort to stabilize the bond market amid the economic turmoil caused by the pandemic. And this means Trump crony Steve Schwarzman and the other chief executive at BlackRock, Lawrence Fink, they're going to be back in the driver's seat. And even though they were responsible for some of the toxic mortgage-backed securities that crashed Wall Street in 2008 and allowed them to multiply their holdings from $1.3 trillion in 2008 to $7 trillion today? The rich get richer. Oh, and get this, America's wealthiest man is even richer because Amazon stock has prospered. Because they're about the, you know, biggest national distribution and sales operation. And despite the risk to their workers in the warehouses and the delivery people, they're open for business and the stock has risen. But right before the top of the market, back in mid-February, Jeff Bezos sold off almost, let me get the number right here, $5.5 billion. Oh, let me get it correct. His wealth has increased $5.5 billion because of the rise in Amazon stock. His sales in mid-February were a mere $3.4 billion of Amazon shares. There's no indication that he had insider information. But it sure does stink, doesn't it? Today I'm releasing an in-depth interview to subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And my guest is Tony Platt, a radical criminologist and the author of a book called Beyond These Walls, subtitled Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. Tony Platt has been a longtime critic of what he calls the carceral state. And in this excerpt, he explains what he means.
There's no question that, you know, policing and jails and prisons play a very critical role in trying to maintain control and regulation and reproduce inequality and so on. But in the book, I argue that there's a broader way of trying to understand what the carceral state is. And by carceral, I'm referring to the institutions that are engaged in the work of social control. So if you go back through the long history of the United States, you find that educators, public health officials, social workers, government officials, politicians, have also been engaged in all kinds of institutions that I would refer to as carceral. So let me give you maybe a few examples of that to make that argument. So, for example, during World War I, when American troops had a high incidence of venereal disease, public health authorities and federal authorities rounded up some 30,000 women and put them in institutions that were prison-like. They were basically contained and not allowed to leave. The men, meanwhile, who were in the army camps were given education and were given health care and were given treatment. And the women were rounded up without trial, without due process, without any kind of investigation of whether crimes had been committed. And they were basically then criminalized for engaging in sexual activity. Or take, for example, in the period after World War II, when there was a crackdown on gay men in government positions, there you had people losing jobs, not being allowed to take jobs. This happened to thousands and thousands of gay men throughout the country. There was a survey, for example, done in the late 50s, early 60s, that reported that one out of three gay men had said that they'd been harassed or beaten or jailed by the police on the basis of their sexuality, which is somewhat comparable to what young black men report today about their activities with policing and so on.
You can hear the full interview with Tony Platt, and in it I share some of my experience in radicalization and my work to reform prisons and to protect innocent people who've been incarcerated. That's available today at peterbcollins.com, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher, and possibly outlets I'm not even aware of. And every day I often pause here when I remember to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to this podcast. And today I'm going to replace my usual soft pitch appeal for you to become a subscriber with an update from some listeners. I explained yesterday that I was a little bit aghast that my Wednesday podcast had so much content that it ran over an hour. I think it was an hour and 8 minutes. And I have expanded the podcast because people have more time right now and because there is so much to cover. But I still try to keep in mind the limited time that people, busy people have, and also just attention spans. And so I asked yesterday how many people got all the way to the end to Wednesday's podcast. And my most delightful response is this one. Hello from Ukraine, Peter. I really like the extended PBC version. More of them would be much appreciated. Also, I would like to thank all the PBC contributors that kick in so people like me in poor ex-commie countries that can't afford it can listen to your great show. Communism at work for us, the customers. Regards, Emir Krupich. Well, Emir, I'm delighted to hear from you. I didn't know you were listening in Ukraine, and you are welcome to be a free rider here. That's why I do it. Also, I want to note that Benny Alto in Oregon, John Zwiebel in Hawaii, and Peggy Anderson, I don't remember, Minnesota, I think. She writes, I listened. I wouldn't miss a word for no matter how long. I appreciate the coverage. Wouldn't want you to leave out anything you felt was worthy of report and comment. I don't always agree, almost, but not always. But your comment always provokes thought. It's especially valuable that you cover news we don't catch on other sources. Well, Peggy, thank you very much. I really appreciate that comment. And I'm glad you don't agree with everything. I would be disappointed if you are somehow just listening to me and buying everything I offer. I like to provoke people to think, and I don't expect even anyone to agree with me all the time. Now to our daily COVID-19 news update, edited by Linda Lewis. Here are the grisly numbers. So far in the U.S., the CDC reports over 85,000 cases, 1,246 deaths, while CNN is reporting their numbers at 95,000 cases and at least 1,451 fatalities. New hotspots are emerging in Chicago, Detroit, and New Orleans, and there is more speculation that backs up my own hunches that it was Mardi Gras that led to a huge transmission zone in New Orleans. And, of course, many of those people are from all parts of the country, including some folks who came from other countries to share the excitement on Fat Tuesday in New Orleans. And we have to argue that the complacency was at least in part due to the way Donald Trump was describing things right up until he got serious for a week in the middle of March. Of course, that's over. But we can all recall that there was a moment where he appeared to take it seriously. The worldwide numbers, 20,834 deaths and 462,000 cases. In Britain, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has tested positive for the coronavirus. And I didn't mention Prince Charles because I don't really care about the royals in Britain, but he is a public figure and people know about him. And it is amazing that somehow it crept into the royal residences. I don't know if he was at Windsor or where exactly he lives these days. Also, the health secretary in Britain has tested positive. And interesting news from Korea, where a doctor, quoted in Wired magazine, criticized the U.S. for being very late in realizing the importance of mass testing for the virus and is risking suffering a crisis like the one in Italy, and that Trump's pride and ego will have global repercussions. Quote, Trump has spoken dismissively about testing because of his ego. As we scientists see it, he is motivated by pride. And he added, in the U.S., Trump is talking about taking care of his own, but the entire world has to respond in sync. A letter to the Supreme Court, published on Friday, came from a group of people who are dreamers covered by the DACA order that was originated by President Obama and arbitrarily ended by Trump as a way to try to pressure congressional action to fund the border wall, the southern border wall. And they are the victims, the hostages of Trump's political maneuver. In a letter to the justices, dreamers said there are 27,000 DACA recipients who are working in healthcare as nurses, home health aides, pharmacists. The pandemic sheds new light on the reliance interests of healthcare providers and the public health consequences of ignoring those interests. Now, There is some confusion about whether Trump has invoked the Defense Production Act, because he's gone back and forth on this. And in particular, it appears today that he issued a flurry of tweets, kind of nasty ones, telling General Motors to get its act together and start producing ventilators. And this squabble over ventilators is a serious one. Governor Cuomo in New York says he needs 30 or 40,000 of them for the projected peak of the virus in his state. And Trump, on Sean Hannity last night, said he doubts that. And you know, words fail when you try to talk about the irresponsibility of him trusting his opinion more than what the governor of his former home state is calling for. Also, in a letter to the nation's governors, Trump is outlining a system to conduct robust surveillance testing that would allow the federal government to classify counties with respect to continued risks posed by the virus, rather than apply one set of nationwide social distancing guidelines. And there is now a call today for a nationwide shelter in place. And it is true that there are some areas that haven't been hit yet. But because of the travel and all those Mardi Gras people and the spring break kids from Florida who are on the beach sharing hookahs and beers and playing volleyball together, I don't think there is any state that can consider itself safe. And then there's Dr. Deborah Birx, the administration's coronavirus response coordinator. She brushed aside concerns that county-by-county criteria would be somehow permeable. She said that part of the current 15-day push for social distancing was to message the necessity to contain the spread while encouraging highly responsible behavior between counties. And Linda Lewis notes, Birx's assumptions do not hold water. The threat is very different from HIV, which is what she previously was involved in managing in Africa, in terms of transmission routes and impacts on conducting business. And the U.S. social structure is very different from Africa's. Due to shortages of affordable housing, many lower-wage American workers travel long distances through multiple jurisdictions. And this is true. We've already seen many cases of people defying guidelines, and there are still vast shortages of equipment essential to the success of the proposed plan. In pushing for this plan, the Trump administration is telling state and local officials, don't believe your own eyes, and it's a prescription for failure, Linda says. In a moment, I'll get to the squabble over ventilators, and Trump, of course, is shit-tweeting state governors who complain that they don't have what they need. But before we get to that, a teenage boy in Los Angeles is believed to be the first teen in the United States to die from complications of COVID-19. And the problem was, his pre-existing condition was he did not have insurance. He went to an urgent care clinic, but he didn't have insurance, so they did not treat him, says the mayor of Lancaster, California. He'd been sick for a few days, had no previous health conditions. I want to share with you one of the sites that I visit every day to update myself on developing news. And it's called Rough and Tumble. It's based out of Sacramento, and it's a digest or an aggregation of all of the political news in California. Now, in the current situation, they've expanded their scope to include listings of all the newspaper articles and some television accounts of what's going on in California. So let me just, I'm going to read the headlines here. Santa Clara County could see 2,000 deaths in 12 weeks, but that is a report from the city of San Jose, which is seated in Santa Clara County. The county health people are saying that is an extreme worst-case scenario. Next story from the LA Times, U.S. surpasses China and Italy in coronavirus cases. From Reuters, coronavirus could kill 81,000 in U.S. and subside in June. That's a Washington University analysis. From the San Francisco Chronicle, Mayor London Breed lashes out at Trump for ridiculous suggestions like reopening the country by Easter and lack of federal help. From the L.A. Times, how 1,000 people with coronavirus in L.A. County can turn into 1 million in a few weeks. And let's see where this is from. Also, the San Francisco Chronicle, Bay Area cases climb as testing grows. 26% test positive at a site in suburban Hayward. Also from the Chronicle, Bay Area testing, how many have been tested? When will it increase? Washington Post, as they rush to save lives, healthcare workers are updating their own wills and funeral plans. So you get the idea. And I'm sharing my secret with you. I don't get any kickbacks from rtumble.com, but it is a great way to catch up on the news, and then click on the stories that you're most curious about. So now to this squabble over ventilators. And before I get to this, I watched Andrew Cuomo's daily briefing again today, and I can hold two ideas at the same time. Yesterday, I shared a negative report about how Cuomo is trying to jam in a rollback in the previous rollback of the requirement of cash bail for criminal suspects. So I don't I'm not recanting any criticism on that basis. But when he holds these briefings, he demonstrates what Trump lacks in so many ways. He delivers detailed information. I believe it's written for him and it's on a teleprompter or a screen. But he does it in a way that's very easy to understand. And today, he offered some compassionate remarks about the healthcare frontline workers, about the victims, about the families who can't visit their victims when they're in isolation due to coronavirus. And he just came across as a strong leader with a very human side. Now, I'm not proposing that the Democrats jam him in as their nominee for president. Some people have. But I do respect the way he has managed New York in this situation. So he claims he needs 30,000 ventilators. And the federal government sent him 4,000. On Thursday, Trump scoffed at that, saying, "I don't believe it." And he told Sean Hannity, the sycophant, "You know, you go into major hospitals, sometimes they'll have two ventilators, and now all of a sudden they're saying, can we order 30,000? Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York, says Trump fails to grasp the severity of the outbreak. And so, as of Friday morning, 1,600 patients in New York State were in intensive care units, most of them on ventilators, a 22% increase in just one day. And an interesting figure delivered by Cuomo this morning is that last week, the number of new cases confirmed was doubling in New York State every 2.5 days. And probably due to the shelter-in-place requirements and the shutting down of a lot of businesses, that has been slowed. It's only doubling every 4 days now. But it is still doubling. And the idea that Easter Sunday is this arbitrary time when everything's going to get better is just ridiculous. And the other person that Trump is attacking is the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. And she may have been a little bit more strident than Cuomo, who is fairly deft in not confronting or contradicting Trump, but simply maintaining his position and hoping that the White House is going to come through. But on Hannity's show last night, Trump ripped into Whitmer. "She's not stepping up. All she does is sit there and blame the federal government. She doesn't get it done. And we send her a lot. She's a new governor, and it's not been pleasant." But the fact is, Michigan has gotten zero ventilators since the distress call was put out by the governor. I don't know exactly when that was, but it was at least a week ago. And as you know, I have a member of my extended family who's on a ventilator in Detroit. The word I got today is his condition has improved slightly, and we are hopeful. But Michigan asked for 2,000 ventilators, and they have zero. And they are the fifth largest hotspot of any state in the country. And I mentioned the confusion over General Motors and whether Trump actually invoked the law to order them to make ventilators. But on Wednesday, they were ready to announce a joint venture between GM and Ventec Life Systems. And GM identified a shuttered plant in Kokomo, Indiana, where the ventilators would be made. And the New York Times reports that there have been shifting numbers about just how many they could make in the immediate future and what the price would be. The number that was offered was $1 billion, and at that point, Trump put it on hold. But at least for PR purposes, he is ordering General Motors to create a production line for ventilators. One of the complications of the federal government response is that so many of the senior positions in Washington are either vacant or filled by acting officials. Trump likes acting officials so he can bully them because they cling to the hope that they'll get the job full time, but he just dangles that so he can, call them up on the phone and bark at them. Over at Homeland Security, Trump's first major action to combat the coronavirus, that agency is full of vacancies. Of the 75 senior positions listed on the department's website, 20 are either vacant or filled by acting officials. The Gray Lady, the New York Times today, put a splash of color in a top-to-bottom graph of the unemployment claims that have been filed in the past week, 3.3 million. And it does have pretty significant impact. A couple of other items here. The Trump administration, the EPA, run by Andrew Wheeler, the former coal industry lobbyist, has suspended its enforcement of all environmental laws, saying that companies won't face any sanction for polluting the air or water of Americans. Now, we've got a respiratory virus threatening mass numbers of people in this country. And coal plants can spew. Refineries can continue to operate, even ones that have been shown to be producing benzene and other effluents that put people's lives at risk. And we know that so many of those toxic facilities are in communities of poverty, communities of color. There's a report from Malaysia where the largest plant that manufactures condoms has been shut down for more than a week. And a global shortage of love gloves is looming at a time when there's already a baby boom expected because so many people are secure in their homes right now. I'm running long here, but I have to take a moment here to recommend to you a remarkable column by Max Boot, a man who I've got a lot of negative feelings about. He was a member of PNAC, a big promoter of the invasion of Iraq, where he didn't care much about the loss of life. But he's become a never-Trumper. His commentary at the Washington Post today is headlined, "Now We Know the Conservative Devotion to Life Ends at Birth." I'll just quote the first paragraph. "After watching so many on the right deny the science of climate change for so many years, I'm not remotely surprised to now see so many conservatives denying the reality of the novel coronavirus. I am, however, shocked to see that the pro-life movement is so willing to sacrifice the lives of the elderly and ailing in a sick attempt to restart the U.S. economy while we are struggling with more coronavirus cases than any other country. Apparently, the right-wing devotion to life ends at birth." Now, the surprise move in Israel yesterday, where Benny Gantz capitulated and gave up his hope to become prime minister by signing on to this crisis government. He's going to be the speaker of the Knesset, and there is a proposal, but it's not confirmed that it's active. Netanyahu has proposed a three-year government in which he would stay on as prime minister for the next 18 months, and then Benny Gantz would take over for the following 18. But the real truth comes from Mint Press News, in the voice of Miko Pellet. He's the son of an Israeli general who I've interviewed. You could probably find the podcast if you search over here at peterbcollins.com. And he really pulls back the curtain and reveals that it is racism against the Arab Joint List. They have 15 members in the Knesset. They provided a bulk of the bare majority that Benny Gantz was able to put together, and it led to the instruction for him to try to form a government. But it's clear that Benny Gantz is captive to the same kind of racism. And speculating, Pellet said that one of the problems would be with the Arab List, part of the coalition that supported a Gantz government, Gantz might not be able to conduct further attacks on the Gaza Strip. And so I encourage you to read this piece. It ends, "Apartheid Israel is alive and well, and at least for now, so is the man leading it," referring to Bibi Netanyahu. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast today. And as I wrap up, we'll give Roy Rogers the day off. Here's a cover of a Bee Gees song that was sent to me by our listener Natalie Reel out in Montana. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening. Oh, and you'll find this on YouTube where the music clip is, but they may black it out because I don't have the musical rights to play it.